Pictures have emerged of Kim Jong-un inside a uranium enrichment plant.
There's a lot of capability there.
I'm Carol Hills. What to make of those pictures as North Korea aims to develop nuclear weapons? And all over the globe, wildlife is a source of wonder. Like, did you ever think of crickets chirping this way?
What they do is sort of the equivalent of like a teenager plugging in the electric guitar.
Awesome nature stories. But first, wildfires are raging in Brazil, and our own Carolyn Beeler is there investigating how climate change is fanning the flames.
It's hot on my face. The wind is kicking it up right now. All right, it's getting a little close.
Those stories and more, all ahead today on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Thanks for being with us today. South America is overwhelmed by wildfires right now. And in Brazil, the worst drought the country has ever seen is fueling blazes nationwide. Major rivers in the Amazon basin are at historic lows, and cities like Sao Paulo have been shrouded in smoke. In the western part of Brazil, a wetland ecosystem roughly the size of England is setting its own fire records. It's called the Pantanal. The World's Carolyn Beeler is there, and she brings us this report on how climate change is fueling unprecedented burning in the Cajuau indigenous territory.
This is the largest tropical wetland in the world, but right now you would not know it looking at it. There are flames crawling across the forest floor in front of me, a foot or 2 feet high, and crawling up the bottoms of tree trunks.
It's hot on my face. The wind is kicking it up right now. All right, it's getting a little close.
The crew of firefighters I'm with is planning out how to attack the fire and putting on extra protective gear in the triple-digit heat. Cleoton Santos Cordero is telling me the fire was likely started by a farmer nearby burning his fields to clear them.
Pela minha experiência, eu acho que sim, acredito que sim.
I talked to him through an interpreter.
All fires I've seen here have been started by people. They lose control of it for two reasons, because the wind is strong and the sparks fly, and also because of climate change. Everything is drier and there is no rain.
Santos and about half a dozen firefighters head into the forest, working along the perimeter of the blaze to clear a fire break with machetes and use leaf blowers to blow sparks and flames back into the area that's already burned.
The leaf blowers are kicking up lots of dust, and it's combining with the smoke to get into your eyes and mouth. This is hot, dirty, lung-burning work.
It's been exceptionally hot and dry here, which fueled big blazes much earlier in the year than usual. June broke fire records due to weather conditions that scientists say were 4 or 5 times more likely because of climate change. Already, 70% of the Cajuau indigenous territory has burned. Firefighting operations for the 200-square-mile territory are being coordinated from the village of Tomazia, where Director of Operations Ronaldo Constantino is glued to satellite imagery of the fires.
Tivemos apoio das aeronaves fazendo lançamento de água lá.
He tells me, while the crew I was with successfully put out their blaze, another team was battling a canopy fire threatening a village across the territory. They sent planes to drop water on the fire, but thick smoke eventually grounded them.
Porque não estava tendo visibilidade dos locais para ser lançadas as águas.
The trees and grasses here right now look like they're painted with a palette of burnt oranges and dusty browns. It all usually greens up in the rainy season, roughly November to April, when much of the Pantanal floods and large parts are accessible only by boat.
Quando tá na época da chuva mesmo, né, aqui a gente não...
Resident Luciana Correio da Silva tells me people don't go out much at that time of year because it's hard to get around. But those floods didn't come this past rainy season, leaving vegetation that's usually underwater much of the year available as wildfire fuel.
Deu uma antecipada também, né? O ano passado mesmo, mês de agosto é o mês...
The blazes got bad in June, before firefighters here had even reported for duty for the season.
When the fires started, we weren't even ready to fight them.
Scientists expect more of the Brazilian Pantanal to burn this year than ever before. Around 15% of it already has. You get a sense of the scope driving around the dirt roads here, which I did with my interpreter, Lina da Anunciação.
It's a pretty devastating landscape. It's almost apocalyptic because you see only black barks, black burned trees. The whole ground is covered by black ashes.
The people in Tomazia are feeling the impacts too, of course. The fires reached the edge of town last month. Village chief Elgis de Souza Abish walks past a dried-out coconut tree to show me the charred bark and blackened soil just past a cattle fence.
Yeah, a gente ficou bastante atento, né, durante a noite.
We were scared because some of the houses in the village are still built with the leaves of this palm, and they burned really quickly, and we were scared that the fire could reach those houses. And it took us 3 days to put this fire down.
No houses did burn, and no one was hurt. Today, the closest fires are miles away, but the sky is still gray with smoke, like it is over many parts of the country. The community health worker here says more kids are coming to the clinic with runny noses and nosebleeds, and patients with respiratory illnesses are having a hard time. In the evening, the temperature finally starts to dip below 100 degrees, and a bunch of high school-age guys play soccer on a concrete court. Several of them say they have a harder time breathing when they play when it's smoky out like this.
E tivemos que parar a aula porque, né, ninguém conseguia respirar.
Their teacher, Elias Góes, tells me how one evening last week he was teaching a class when the smoke got especially thick.
Estava passando na matéria, né?
It was very hard because people couldn't breathe well. You would feel your eyes were burning and the throat as well. And we had to stop the class. Unfortunately, we couldn't go on.
Late in the evening, my interpreter and I get to chatting with our host in Tomazia, Solange Felix Farias. She's in a rocking chair with her feet up after cooking dinner for us and her family.
You can stay just like that. Be comfortable.
Felix says her elders always talked about burning grasslands to renew pastures.
O fogo para o povo Kadjuel, não somente para o povo Kadjuel, né, para os povos originários, né, vamos dizer assim.
It was part of the culture. But at that time, we had rain, and the rain would stop the fires from advancing so fast and so much. And now, I think, due to climate change, the situation is very different.
Felix is a member of the Tarana indigenous community, and as far as she knows, her family's been here in the Pantanal forever. So, given that deep, deep connection to this land, I'm wondering how you feel about the changes that you're seeing.
Então, né, com essa mudança climática que a gente está vivendo hoje, para nós...
For us, the original people of the Pantanal, is a great sadness to see all the plants, all the animals. This fire comes to destroy everything. And for us, is very sad. Because we depend and rely on our environment to survive.
The next morning, as the animals and human inhabitants of the village wake up, I watch from Felix's front yard as firefighters walk under the rising red sun to report for duty. They see some rain in the forecast for this weekend, which might make their jobs easier for a while. But in the long term, scientists expect the Pantanal to see more heat waves, drier conditions, and more wildfires as the climate continues to warm. For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Tomazia, Brazil.
Seeing the inside of North Korea's nuclear facilities is like a dream come true for Western intelligence agencies. And today, North Korea released photos showing just that. In one photo, Kim Jong-un is standing in a huddle with two military personnel and two other people in an aisle flanked by a warren of silver-gray tubes inside what appears to be a uranium enrichment facility. Jenny Town is the director of the Stimson Center's North Korea project called 38 North. I asked her what first jumps out at her from the photos.
This is the first time they've ever shown us their centrifuges, their uranium enrichment facility. And I think the first thing for those of us who have been watching the program develop over the years is these are not the P2 centrifuges that North Korea originally purchased from Pakistan. These are much more advanced centrifuges, most likely North Korean manufactured. It looks like they're using probably carbon filament in it. So this is a huge advancement in their enrichment capabilities. And as well as, you know, if you look at the centrifuge hall itself, there's two different rooms that are being shown in the main facility. There's a lot of capability there. So this is a big facility. They have a lot of capacity for uranium enrichment. And it is at a much more advanced level than what we expected to see if we ever were able to see it.
Now, the fact that the centrifuges look more advanced and that they may have been manufactured by North Korea, what does that tell you about their own capabilities? Or does it mean that they're getting help from some other countries? What does that mean exactly?
You know, the North Koreans have pretty amazing engineers, and they've proven over and over not to underestimate their ability to rise to the occasion. But, you know, certainly they have to get materials from somewhere. And I think that's a bigger question as to, you know, how much of this is being built through outside procurements and where did they get that? How much do they have? And what is their full capacity to expand that over time?
So do you think Western intelligence agencies are looking at these photos and thinking, oh, dear, this is a whole different world? I mean, do you think there's going to be a reaction within countries that are concerned about North Korea that they're dealing with something much more complicated than they thought?
Maybe a little. Certainly, we've known for a long time that North Korea has pretty extensive uranium enrichment capabilities. There's always been questions about, you know, whether they're actually producing low enriched uranium or high enriched uranium, which is the weapons grade fuel. So, you know, I think from the pictures, there's still questions.
Is there any possibility that the thicket of nuclear instruments in this photo are actually fake?
No. This is it's very credible. We've known they've had these facilities, you know, for a decade now. You know, there was a Western delegation led by Siegfried Heckert and the Stanford group that did see the original centrifuge hall. This is an advancement of that.
Why do you think Kim Jong-un is comfortable with releasing this photo? What's he trying to get out of this?
You know, the North Koreans have emphasized, especially over the past year, a real push to expand their nuclear program. I think, you know, you can't look at this in isolation. There's been a lot of developments on the Korean Peninsula, especially this year, where you have, you know, back-to-back U.S.-South Korea military exercises, large-scale live-fire exercises. And you have that leaked memo recently of Biden talking about updating nuclear strategy to also include the threat of North Korea along with the threat of rising China, expanding, you know, Russian nuclear programs. And, you know, all of these things the North Koreans have responded to in a way that sort of echoes of like, if you continue to characterize us as such a threat, we're going to show you what a threat we can be. And I think this adds to the credibility of their capacity to expand the program and advance the program.
Jenny Town is the director of the Stimson Center's North Korea project called 38 North. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. The European Union has had a migration deal in place with Tunisia for a little over a year. The arrangement provides financial support to Tunisia, and in exchange, Tunisia stops migrants from coming to Europe. But a newly leaked report by the EU reveals major concerns about the deal. They largely center around the Tunisian government's continued suppression of political dissent. Mohamed Zia Hamami is a Tunisian political analyst. We reached him in Tunisia's capital, Tunis, near an anti-government protest. I began by asking about the concerns raised in the leaked report.
Well, these concerns were reflected already in several reports published by local organizations as well as international organizations out of human rights. It covers questions that have to do with freedom of expression, suppression of a wide variety of human rights, including the crackdown on challengers of President Kais Saied during the electoral campaign that has just started. There is nothing new when it comes to the evidence about the deterioration of the human rights situation. It's just that the EU has now become concerned about it, which comes pretty late, to be honest.
What are examples of how the Tunisian government has been crushing dissent? Are we talking about arrests, censorship? What are some examples?
So, yes, both. Censorship of outlets such as the magazine Jeune Afrique was banned from the country this month because it had on its front page a picture of the president and several articles critical of him. We've been seeing the creation of or the recreation of the atmosphere of fear that used to exist under Ben Ali through the adoption of a decree law on surveillance of social media. So anyone now can be put in jail and subject to harsh sanctions for having a Facebook post, let's say, for example, critical of the president of his policy. And several activists and leading political figures were jailed because of that.
Now, as we mentioned at the beginning, you attended a protest and we are reaching you on the streets of Tunis. What was the protest about today?
So the protest is about freedom and liberties more generally, and most of the slogans were about Saied's autocratic grip. There were slogans calling him a dictator, others calling for the fall of the regime. Many other slogans were about freedom. Others were about old slogans from the revolution, freedom, dignity, employment. So broadly, we've seen the same demands that we've seen during the revolution. I wouldn't say that the momentum is as strong, but this protest comes to break the atmosphere of fear that has been created over the last 3 years.
And those presidential elections in Tunisia, they're less than a month away. Any chance things could shift? I mean, has anyone managed to put forward a real alternative to Kais Saied?
So the tactic has been to try to prevent him from winning more than 50% in the first round. And so far, it seems that his popularity is below that bar. The idea is to move to the second round with any alternative to Saied and relying on the negative partisanship. So far, this has been the strategy. It's not clear whether or not it is going to work. But what is for sure, the case is that once Saied, let's say, wins the election in the second round, he would have a problem of a legal validation of the results of the elections by the court that issued the decision adding more candidate to the race. So the same court can have the potential to cancel the result of the election, and Saied would have the choice to either ignore it and find himself in a very vulnerable situation, open to other form of challenges, and that's very risky, or organizing a new election, which is very unlikely. So I think that Tunisia is going right now through a critical juncture that is very uncertain, and we don't really know what's going to happen in the next couple of months.
Mohamed Zia Hamami is a Tunisian political analyst. In the U.S., long yellow school buses are a sure sign that the academic year has begun. But in Barcelona, there's another sign. It's called the Bicibus, which translates as bicycle bus. Basically, groups of children and parents who take over roads in the morning to pedal to school en masse. As Jerry Haddon first reported a couple years ago, it's 50% environment protest, 50% safety measure, and 100% good time.
In the year since BC busing began, the two-wheeled convoys have been starting up all over the city. Today's the maiden voyage of the latest, but this bicycle bus begins in the hills high above Barcelona. Six kids and their parents wearing bright yellow traffic vests gather with their bikes on a small square. I'm doing this because I don't want to pollute, says 7-year-old Pau Barrios. Pau's mother, Berta Barrios, is one of the chaperones. We're here for a lot of reasons, she says. First, for safety. Second, for the sense of community it offers. We're getting together with other families from the neighborhood, she says. The first leg of their trip to school, a long, winding descent toward Barcelona on a rural road with fast-moving cars. A police escort arrives to block the traffic, and they're off pedaling. 7-year-old Pau's out front for about 7 seconds. An officer orders everyone to stop. He wants them all closer together. If they get too spread out, they're just a bunch of people on bikes. Together, they're a single unit, more like a bus. And cars respect buses more than bikes. Luckily, this morning, the cops have things under control. But there are other challenges for these newbies. The BC Boost turns onto a dirt road. There, it swerves around some startled off-leash dogs and their owners out for their morning strolls. Then the bus stops at a fork in the trail. I'm not sure which way to go, says Barrios, looking around. It's this way to the left, the dad says, downhill. Once unlost, it's down they go. I'm on my supersonic motorcycle, yells Pau. Just about wherever you live now in Barcelona, kids can hop on a BC Bus. They're organized through schools. Same's true in several towns across northeast Spain, where mayors are pushing for fewer cars on the road. Pollution and climate change are serious issues. Still, BC Bus chaperones try to focus on the fun. This is, after all, for kids. Mom Berta Vasquez brings the tunes. She strapped a big speaker to her bike with bungee cords. We play music to create a festive atmosphere, she says, compared to the people crammed together in those cars and buses. This way, she says, the kids get to school fired up. On this four-lane artery, there are cars and buses aplenty. Volunteer Berta Palau says sometimes their police escort is a no-show. When that happens, harried commuters honk at the riders. Let them, she says. This is a protest, even if the impact is small, she says. At least we're no longer a shock to people on the road. She says we become part of the urban landscape. What's not yet part of the urban landscape here? Enough bike lanes. But Barcelona's working on it. It now has over 120 miles worth. It's not Berlin or Copenhagen, but it's adding more each year. The goal is to get BC buses like these onto dedicated lanes. No need for police. But for now, patrol cars escort them, whether it's down Main Street or down from the mountain. For The World, I'm Jerry Haddon in Barcelona.
Controversy erupts in South Africa over race in public schools.
The South African Constitution says that education is a basic human right. Every child, regardless of what the color of their skin is, should get quality education.
Why the legacy of apartheid in the classroom is still divisive, ahead on The World. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Some of nature's curiosities are so spectacular that you pretty much can't miss them. But then there are things you aren't going to see unless you know what you're looking for, like ants that live in treetops that protect their colonies by blowing themselves up, or psychedelic toad milk. I'll repeat that, psychedelic toad milk. A new book by the folks at Atlas Obscura sets out to catalog some of the living creatures whose behavior ought to be up there with the great wonders of the world. It's called, fittingly enough, Wildlife, an explorer's guide to the world's living wonders. Kara Jaimo and Joshua Four are the authors. Hi, Kara.
Hi.
And hello to you, Josh.
Hello.
We'll hear more about the concept of this book in a moment, but I want to start by diving in and asking you about some of our favorite entries. Now, Kara, tell us about this creature we're hearing now. It's an adorable flightless parrot that lives on isolated islands off the coast of New Zealand.
Yes, we are listening to the sound of the kakapo. This is really one of the funkiest and cutest birds probably in the world. they look a little bit like bowling pins. They're very round. They have these sort of like shiny green and yellow feathers. And like a lot of birds in Oceania, they are very, very endangered, very rare, because something cool about that part of the world is that birds evolved there sort of without a lot of large mammals to eat them. So they got very strange. Kakapos, they're not very good at flying. They're not very good at hiding. They're not very good at doing any of the things that you might expect birds to do. That kind of makes them endearing, but it also makes them have trouble surviving in a place where there are now things like stoats, rats, introduced predators that they see a kakapo and they basically see like a rotisserie chicken just like sitting in the middle of the path.
So they're endangered. What's being done to try to protect them?
Scientists have done really unusual things in pursuit of allowing these birds to have more offspring and therefore survive. For a little while, they were using something called a sperm copter to fly kakapo sperm from the sperm emitter to the sperm receiver based on, you know, genetically who the best match would be. They would get a sample in the wild and like drone it over to another bird. There are just like a lot of different ways that they have tried to matchmake these kakapos to enable them to keep existing. And so far, it's going okay. At the same time, they're doing predator eradication so that these birds can be safe being their strange little selves.
Now, Josh, we're going to travel now to two of the longest rivers in South America, the Amazon and the Orinoco, home of these almost fantastical creatures. So, Josh, what are we hearing?
I think that we're listening to some pink river dolphins.
We certainly are.
Well, this is a species that's close to my heart. I've been very lucky to travel the world, and part of my career as a nature wildlife journalist, see lots of the most interesting, charismatic creatures that we've got. These are some of the most special. So the pink river dolphins of South America are probably been in South America for about 16 million years when there was an inland sea.
Wow.
And when you look at them, and I actually had a really extraordinary encounter with one in Peru. One had been caught up in a fisherman's net, and I was with somebody, and we helped release this dolphin from the net and got, you know, right up about a foot from his eye, looking eye to eye at him as we were cutting this net open. And I don't think I've ever looked into an animal's eye and said, there is something going on here, quite in the way that there was with the pink river dolphin. They're incredibly smart. Their brains are humongous. And they've got this glowing pink skin, particularly the males, that it almost looks like human Caucasian skin, which is part of what's so unnerving about them.
I understand also that these pink river dolphins are quite the gymnasts. What do they do?
You know, the rivers of the Amazon are quite murky. So unlike, say, the freshwater rivers of the Potomac or the Charles, you really need echolocation underwater to make your way around. And it's part of the reason that they've survived so well, we think, over so long. And by the way, one of the things that's really interesting about them is that when they see humans, they're remarkably affectionate. They're interested in us.
Kara, I want to ask you about that. I mean, what was the thinking behind this book, Wildlife, about these kind of living world wonders? What inspired it?
Yeah, so the ethos of Atlas Obscura has always been to sort of look around the world and find things that will make you feel like you didn't actually know everything that was going on after all. So I think in our time of being hyper-connected by the internet, you can get this sort of jaded feeling like, I know everything that's out there. But Atlas Obscura tries to sort of disrupt that, like showing you that it's actually impossible to know everything incredible and amazing that's going on around us. People talk about how, like, oh, what if aliens came to visit? To me, like, looking around, it's like we have alien life all over this planet, and we don't always remember to appreciate that or think about it that way.
Kara, I want to ask you about the golden poison frog. Now, the toxins it carries around in its glands, on its back, and behind its ears are 1,000 times more poisonous than cyanide. But these frogs aren't poisonous when they're born. Is that right?
Yes. So the frogs build up these toxins by eating beetles. And then it's also thought that the beetles build up the toxins by eating plants. So as the beetles eat the plants and then the frogs eat the beetles, the poison is sort of refined and concentrated until it's, like you said, just incredibly toxic.
Now, I understand they were used traditionally for hunting. How did that work?
Yes. So I believe they still are. Indigenous people in this rainforest called the Choco Rainforest will take arrows or darts and just sort of briefly swipe them along the backs of these frogs.
I'm speaking with Kara Jaimo and Joshua Four, the authors of Atlas Obscura's latest book, Wildlife, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Living Wonders. All right, now we're going to talk about crickets. That's a great chirping sound. Kara, how do most crickets, how do they make that chirping sound? In the book, you describe it as playing the cello.
Yes, so they actually make this sound by rubbing their front wings together, sort of like the way a cellist will rub a bow against strings.
It's so incredible. But you've written about the smallest tree crickets that have a trick for upping the volume on their chirp. How do they do it?
Yeah, so I think as humans, we think of cricket chirps as being very peaceful and sort of getting across this like ambiance of a quiet night. But crickets themselves are actually trying to be very loud because they're trying to impress their mates. They're trying to show off how big and loud they are. But some crickets are not naturally big and loud. So what they do is sort of the equivalent of like a teenager plugging in the electric guitar. They find a leaf and they nibble a hole of a very special size and shape. And when they stand in that hole and they do their little cello sawing at their wings, it amplifies the sound so that they sound much louder than they are.
And the female crickets say, hey, that's really cool.
Yeah, they love it. They come, they hang out, they listen for a long time. It really works. It's just like an amp.
It's amazing. So we're going to go back to the Amazon now for a bird that has shattered the record for the loudest call. Wait for it. That's what a white bellbird coming in at 125 decibels, somewhere between a chainsaw and a military jet taking off. Josh, why are they so loud?
Because they are hitting on females, and it's like being hit on by a pile driver. So it seems to be the case that the males started, you know, making these loud noises, and the ones that were making the loudest noises were getting the mates, and so it just became this kind of runaway competition. And now they are the most obnoxious bar guests on any tree limb.
What do they look like? Are we talking about a little songbird or kind of a bigger bird?
No, these are not huge birds, but what they do have is monstrous abs. I mean, what makes that sound is a set of stomach muscles that can push out a huge amount of air very quickly. So they are like the, you know, the Whitney Houstons of the bird world. They've got great pipes.
All right, we're going to go to a different sound now. To most people, this sounds like a baby crying. But you know what it really is, right, Carol?
Yes, this is one of many incredible and unexpected sounds in the repertoire of the lyrebird.
That's amazing. How does this lyrebird make that noise?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, here in the States, we have mockingbirds, which are able to imitate mostly the sounds of other birds. In Australia, they have these lyrebirds that can imitate basically anything they want. Babies, they'll imitate chainsaws, they'll imitate potentially flutes, like melodic flute songs. It's sort of up to them.
Do they do it because they just mimic sounds, that's kind of their thing? Or is this, again, a mating thing?
It's probably at least partly associated with mating. Most communication that birds and other animals do is to talk to each other or to signal something to each other. But there are definitely people who consider it to also be music, like sort of part of their culture. In the book, we interviewed a musicologist named Hollis Taylor, who studies lyrebird songs and uses them to inform her own work. And to her, it's not just, you know, a mating call the way we think of as like a utilitarian thing. It's an expression of their environment, you know, piecing together different sounds that they've heard over time, the same way that a human musician would.
I'm curious, do Australians keep them as pets and teach them weird sounds just for fun?
You know, I'm not sure if that's going on right now, but one of the most enduring legends about lyrebirds is that there's a mysterious sort of lineage called flute lyrebirds, which in this telling, which may or may not be true, the jury's kind of out. Someone in the 1920s took a lyrebird home and taught it flute sounds by playing beautiful melodies on the flute and then released it. And this lyrebird went and taught the flute melodies to its friends. They were sort of remixed over time and they became part of the sound of this bird in this area.
Okay, listen to this one. Now, these are hermit crabs, famous for their housing swaps. You write about the hot hermit crab real estate market. How does it work, Carol?
Yeah, so as most people know, hermit crabs are really cute. They live in little shells, but they don't grow their own shells. They have to get them from their environment, the same way that people have to move into a house. So what happens is they get their shells from snails. When a snail dies and sort of, you know, falls out of its shell, it emits a certain chemical, and all the hermit crabs from everywhere around come to see the shell. And they sort of ask themselves, is this going to be a better shell for me than the one that I'm in? And so maybe one of them decides, yes, I want to upgrade. He'll get out of his shell and get into the new shell. But that leaves another shell open. And so then another crab says, hey, you know what? That guy's old shell, that could be my new shell. It swaps up as well. And there are whole crowds of hermit crabs that do this. When a snail dies, it sort of like sparks this hermit crab real estate rush, like around the empty shell.
Are there ever shell shortages?
That's a really good question. I actually do happen to know that these days hermit crabs are more and more moving into bottle caps and other discarded human trash, which serves the same purpose for them as a snail shell.
Wow. I'm curious, is there a McMansion effect among hermit crabs? Do they go for sort of bigger and better, or do they just go for sort of the usual size, no matter what the material?
I think it's a little bit like aspirational. Like, you want to move into a shell that's maybe like a little bit bigger than you are now because you want to grow, but you don't want to make it too crazy because then that's like way too heavy to lug around. Because remember, you have to carry your house. So,
do the hermit crabs have kids they have to put in there too?
The kids get their own tiny houses.
Incredible. Kara Jaimo and Joshua Four are the authors of Atlas Obscura's latest book, Wildlife, An Explorer's Guide to the World's Living Wonders. In eastern Libya, the seaside city of Derna just marked the one-year anniversary since two dams broke and a deluge of water came rushing into the city center. Floods devastated Derna and its surrounding communities in a deadly combination of climate change and poor infrastructure. A year later, thousands of people remain missing. The World's Duri Buscarin reports.
A year ago, Malak Al-Hanouchi led a comfortable life as an architect in Derna. Al-Hanouchi and her son lived in a tiny flat on the fifth floor, just over a mile from the river that runs down the center of Derna and empties into the sea. When the rain started to come, she says, she wasn't too worried.
And she thought, like, it's okay. These rains usually come to Derna every winter.
That's Arwa Faroun, a Libyan journalist, translating for us. The river valley had flooded before, but as it started to rain harder, Al-Hanouchi called her sister, who lived closer to the river. She asked her sister to evacuate.
But her sister refused. She was like, no, my husband is coming. We're going to have a dinner. And she thought everything is going to be okay.
At 2:30 a.m., Al-Hanouchi woke up to the screams. Two dams above the city had failed, releasing a 65-foot wave of water down the river. Water rushed into Al-Hanouchi's building, completely submerging the first, second, and third floors. Her neighbors, who were able to escape their apartments, sheltered with her on the fifth floor. But some neighbors on the ground floor didn't get out in time. One woman passed away. Her children survived by treading water for 3 hours, breathing from an air pocket just a few inches from the ceiling. I still can't believe it happened, she says.
It's probably one of the deadliest dam tragedies in the world.
Claudia Gazzini is the senior Libya analyst for the International Crisis Group. She arrived in Derna just a few days after the floods.
Giant blocks of cement of the collapsed buildings and, you know, bridges had been pulled out of their foundations. And so seeing these, you know, individuals with shovels trying to pull out the dead was heartbreaking. In fact, many of the bodies were never recovered.
This is why even a year later, the official death toll is still contested. Many locals believe the death toll is as high as 11,000 people, almost twice the official count.
Even though authorities have done DNA sampling from these bodies, they haven't matched up the samples with DNA samples of the survivors or the families that stated that they have missing loved ones. So everything's very delayed and everything's very confusing.
Malak Al-Hanouchi lost 25 members of her family in the floods. Her sister's body was never found. Every day, she says, she feels the same grief.
Even though 1 year has passed, but it's the same feeling, because every time I go out, I pass from the same streets, the same areas. I remember what happened here, what I've seen in this place.
Al-Hanouchi and her 14-year-old son were displaced for months, staying in old school buildings converted into shelters for survivors. It's here, she says, when she started to notice the kids.
I noticed that the kids were suffering psychologically. Like some of them, they just stay silent, they don't talk. Some of them, they just sit far away, they don't want to speak to anyone, even their families.
Al-Hanouchi reached out to an international charity for funding and supplies, and after some months, she opened an art center for kids in Derna. Al-Hanouchi says 50 kids between the ages of 5 and 17 come during the day to paint, play games, and hang out. The center's almost always at capacity, but Al-Hanouchi says she can't say no when a new kid shows up.
I don't want to stop that, and I want to welcome all the kids because psychological support is very important for them.
Al-Hanouchi calls the center Nabd, Arabic for heartbeat. For the week of the anniversary, she took out all the kids' artworks and displayed the paintings on easels and tables lining the space. Some of the paintings are dark, showing buried bodies and collapsed homes. Others are painted brightly, showing signs of hope. Sometimes healing takes both. For the world, I'm Derry Buscarin.
This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. Today in South Africa, an education bill was signed into law, but not without controversy. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa promised to delay the implementation of two particular measures in the bill, which are at the center of disagreement. But opposition to the bill has not diminished. So let's take a look at it and why it's controversial. Journalist Nomsa Maseko joins us from Johannesburg. Nomsa, what is in this education bill?
Well, there's a lot of other clauses in the bill that are not controversial, and that includes regulating homeschooling and the registration of private schools, and also reinforcing the fact that corporal punishment is now punishable, and whoever carries it out will possibly face jail time. But the issue that is contentious here is the language and admission policy of predominantly Afrikaans medium schools. 13% of South Africans speak Afrikaans as their first language here in South Africa, and that includes white South Africans and mixed race people in the country. So what the government is trying to do is to ensure that schools no longer teach in just one language, particularly the Afrikaans language, because that means the black majority in particular is now excluded because they don't speak that language. However, what the government is trying to do is to ensure that those kind of schools have dual medium languages, which include English and Afrikaans, but that has been opposed.
Afrikaner advocates have raised concerns over the language requirement, saying it would weaken the Afrikaans language skills of fluent speakers and that it infringes on language rights in the country. How serious are these concerns, and could it set a bad precedent for other non-English language schools?
The thing is, you know, with the Afrikaans minority in this country, they want to maintain that vacuum, that little circle in which they are in, which excludes other people that do not speak that language. And they are now saying they want to continue to be taught in their mother tongue. And part of the problem here is the fact that in the 30 years of democracy in South Africa, the government is to blame for what is currently happening. Why does one race think that its language is more superior than the other? Those are some things that were supposed to have been sorted out when South Africa was transitioning into a democracy, not 30 years later, when the entitlement of white African-speaking people is still at an all-time high.
Could the teaching be in both Afrikaans and English, or is it just one or the other and that's it?
Well, for now, it's one or the other. I'll give you an example with my child. She goes to an English medium school, and Afrikaans is taught as a subject in her school. However, in the Afrikaans schools, everything is taught in Afrikaans, including mathematics, history, and all the other subjects. They are taught in strictly Afrikaans. So from a background of a child who's never spoken Afrikaans at home, to go to an Afrikaans school would be very difficult for her.
What's the difference in how well those two schools are resourced, your daughter's school versus the Afrikaans medium school?
Well, those Afrikaans medium schools are well equipped with science labs, with rugby fields, with all kinds of technical training type of classrooms. And all of this is privately funded by the sponsorship or by even the parents of those children. Whereas in the English schools, it is what the government has given you, and you improvise with what you get, including overcrowding in those classrooms where kids are not given enough attention. You find that there are about 40 to almost 50 children per teacher in those schools. And then in the Afrikaans medium schools, there's about 20 students, and the majority of those are white Afrikaans-speaking children.
Does this new law address those inequities in terms of the privately funded resources of the Afrikaans medium schools versus the publicly funded resources of the English medium schools?
Not necessarily. And this is where the government is faltering, because the government needs to realize that the overcrowding in schools can also be sorted out by building more schools in the country and not forcing white kids to go to school with black kids when some of those white parents are racist and they would not like that to happen. So I think that the language policy and the admission policy issue is something that is seen by some as a scapegoat by the government to ensure that there's inclusivity and equality there. At the same time, why are they not building more schools when there is so much tax money that is being collected from South Africans, and yet the money just disappears because of the many corruption scandals that the country has seen? So there's a lot that still needs to be done, and it needs to be done very quickly.
So as things stand now, there's going to be this discussion period. And then do you have any sense of what's likely to happen? Is this law going to go through with these controversial measures, or is Cyril Ramaphosa going to compromise or cave to the Democratic Alliance?
Well, President Ramaphosa has said that if there is no common ground that is reached, then the bill will have to be signed as is. However, because the judiciary in this country is very much independent, those who oppose the bill can take the government to court, and then it will have to be decided by a court of law. So it's not just going to be a black and white issue, but I think that it will take months, if not years, for the implementation of this, if it's going to happen at all, because definitely the white Afrikaans-speaking community is definitely going to oppose this in court.
Nomsa Maseko is a correspondent for the BBC. She joined us from Johannesburg. Finally today, we trace the fascinating journey of a garment. Indigenous leaders in Brazil are celebrating after a Danish museum returned a sacred cloak. It had been on display in Denmark for more than 300 years. The nearly 6-foot-long cloak is made of bright red feathers from the scarlet ibis bird. 4,000 red feathers. The cloak was taken from the Tupinamba people during the colonial period. The country's Minister for Indigenous Peoples, Sonia Guajajara, spoke yesterday at a ceremony honoring its return to Brazil. She said the cloak represents the exuberance of a rich past, as well as hope for a dignified future for all Indigenous peoples of Brazil. The Tupinamba people view the cloak as a living ancestor, not just an object. It has a role in rituals and prayers. Its return is part of ongoing diplomatic efforts by the Brazilian government to recover indigenous artifacts from museums around the world. That's where we'll leave it. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.